All right, now I'll take roughly an hour to speak so you can be done waiting whenever I'm done, even if it's not an hour. Whenever I'm done, you can get your final measurements. As I said, this is your second report you're going to write up, so I'll talk more about that in a second. But first, I need you to realize something important, which is, yes, I'm standing in the lab giving you a lecture that has to do with what you're doing in lab, but the stuff I'm saying today on this lecture, unlike the rest of the lab weeks, is really lecture material as well. I'm going to go through three slides from the slideshow that I usually do upstairs because I can't fit them in. So this is a lecture for lecture material for the test, upcoming test, but it's also stuff for the lab as well. Everyone understand? It can be, yeah. Anything I say could be on the quiz as well. But it takes a little longer than usual to get through the three slides I'm going to show you eventually. Before I even get to that, though, let me talk a little bit about transport process. I started this today upstairs. There are three mechanisms of transport that can get things into or out of cells, and I gave you one of them already. What was that? Right. Vesicular transport is one of the three ways that you can get things into or out of cells. And in a sense, it's a cheating mechanism because if you think about those pictures, using a vesicle is a way to get something into or out of the cell without that thing actually going through a membrane. Right? If it's outside and you engulf it, you're surrounding it with membrane, it never goes through a membrane, right? It's now in a vesicle, which is inside the cell, and if you open up that vesicle, it's fully inside the cell, but it never passed through a membrane. So that's why I say it's kind of a cheating mechanism, but it's one of the three categories. Anyone have any idea what the other two are? Transport mechanisms. What kind of transport? Active transport and passive transport are the other two. And things definitely go through the membrane in those cases. But what is the distinction between active and passive transport? It's the requirement, if any, of expenditure of additional energy. Now, some books might tell you that passive transport doesn't require energy. That's not true. Nothing's going to move for free. So both passive and active transport require energy. The difference is that in passive transport, the energy that drives that is already built in. It's part of the system. Whereas in active transport, that's never going to happen unless you supply outside energy. All right? And I'll explain what the source of this energy is in a minute. But active transport, which is not what I'm going to talk much more about right now, I will eventually get to that in lecture upstairs. Active transport requires some sort of outside energy. Now, sometimes that source of energy is ATP. It doesn't have to be ATP, but it has to be some sort of external source of energy. And active transport is the only kind of transport that is able to move materials against what is called a gradient. Gradient is roughly just another word for a difference. There's all kinds of gradients. For instance, water comes out of your faucet because of a pressure gradient. There's a difference in pressure inside and outside the pipe. That's one example of a gradient. What we call voltages are gradients. Those are gradients of electrical potential energy. So one side of the AC receptacle is at a different electrical potential energy than the other. So there's a gradient that we call a voltage. The gradients that we care about in today's lab are concentration gradients. But any given gradient is some difference in a measurement taken at A versus B, two different places. We're talking about concentration gradients today, though. So that means A and B are two different places. A has a different concentration of solutes than B does. That, if so, then that's a gradient. If there is no difference, we can either say that the gradient doesn't exist or that it's zero, because the gradient itself is the difference. If the concentrations are identical, then there is zero concentration difference, zero concentration gradient. All that makes sense? Okay, now passive transport, which is what we're really concerned with directly in today's lab, is movement of materials down a gradient. By down, I mean from high concentration to low concentration. That's passive transport. And passive transport, when it comes to tiny particles, is diffusion. Diffusion is passive transport. Okay. Now, diffusion, which I just said is passive transport, is a directed movement, meaning it occurs in a specific direction, namely down the gradient. So it's a directed movement of particles that is based on random movement of particles. And that might seem counterintuitive, if you think about it. How can random movement of particles lead to movement in a certain direction? That's what seems kind of like a paradox. Well, that random motion is for all particles, right? Anything above absolute zero, which is every material in the universe, has particles that are moving at some speed. That's what temperature is all about, right? Even if they're in solids, they're vibrating back and forth, but they're moving. Here we're not talking about solids, we're talking about liquid solutions. So the particles are all moving, and they're moving in random directions. Each individual particle is moving at its own speed, instantaneously, at any given moment, at its own speed, in its own direction. But though overall, it's random movement. And we call that random movement Brownian motion. In honor of some dead dude named Brown. Well, I'm assuming it's a dude because that's about all we let work in science for decades, unfortunately. But anyway, Brownian motion is just this random movement of particles in any sample. Now I want to explain how random movement can give rise to directed diffusion in one direction. I usually use just a thought exercise. You could actually go through with this, but it's enough to just imagine it. If you use people to represent particles in solution, so if I got a crowd of willing participants, each person would represent a molecule or a solute particle. This is a two-dimensional exercise, but in reality, of course, the particles are moving in three dimensions. The point is still the same in two dimensions. If you get these people all together in a big room like a gymnasium and you stop the clock, time is not passing yet while you set this up, and you just huddle the people together in the middle of the room, like these dots are their heads. And you not only put them all together in the middle of the room, like a clump of solute, for instance, like a chunk of salt, but you also just randomly turn each person to a certain direction that they're facing. Whatever direction a person is facing while they're still, while time is standing still, that's the direction that they're going to start walking in to represent the motion of the particle when I start the clock. All right, so they're just randomized to begin with. If I do that and I say, okay, let's start time, that means everyone start walking in the direction you are facing. Well, all of these people that are in the middle of the clump, it doesn't matter which way they're facing, right? They're just going to run into each other. And when you do run into a particle or a wall, you need to bounce off in the appropriate direction and start walking in that direction, just like real particles do when they encounter each other. But they're just going to be bouncing back and forth, not going anywhere really, right? They're just moving around, but not very far. On the periphery, though, the edge of this mass, there are some people who just happen to randomly be facing inward, so they're not going to get very far either. They're just going to bounce off the other people. Some of those people, though, will be randomly facing outward. And they will, therefore, be able to leave the group, which is just based on random movement, right? And the more they leave, you know, they're going to walk until they hit a wall and then start walking in another direction, but they're no longer part of the group. And the more that happens, the more other people will have a chance of being on the edge facing the right direction to leave as well. So even though this is all randomized motion, the effect is that over time, the concentration will change. It's now highly concentrated in the middle, very low concentration where there's no people yet. And over time, the movement will be such that the particles, the people, move from where there's a higher concentration of them to where there's a lower concentration of them. That's the directed aspect of it. But it's all caused by random Brownian motion. And if people are cooperating with me and I get back from lunch and they're still doing it, then they'll be all spread out, bouncing off of each other, but equally spaced, right? And in that case, there's equal concentration everywhere, so there wouldn't be a gradient anymore. Right now, there's a gradient. If this is place A and this is place B, this is high concentration, this is low concentration, and that's the direction of movement overall, of net movement. They're still going to be moving individually in random directions, but as a whole, they're going to tend to go from high concentration to low concentration. That's what diffusion is. So when I said that that doesn't happen for free, I said that all movement requires energy. Well, in this case of diffusion, passive transport, the source of that energy is built in. It's the random movement, the Brownian motion, the thermal motion of the particles to begin with. So there is no requirement of additional energy being spent to cause diffusion. It will happen because of the gradient. The gradient itself is the source of energy. And that will become really important over and over upstairs in lecture, especially in Unit 3. You should always keep in mind that a gradient is a form of potential energy, stored energy, that can be possibly put to use. In this case, that potential energy is what drives the actual diffusion. Active transport can move things against their gradients, though. And active transport can move things from where they're already sparse to where they're already stockpiled. That's exactly the opposite direction in which they would like to move by diffusion. And that's why it's never going to happen unless you force it to happen by supplying external energy to do that. That's the distinction between those other two non-vesicular transport processes. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's look at some pictures then as I go through these slides. First one is slide 10 of this chapter that we haven't gotten to yet. So when I do this chapter in upstairs, I'm just going to skip over these three slides, but it's still part of lecture, remember. In slide 10, we can see diffusion represented by these molecules of dye, orange dye in water. Now, the water isn't shown as particles, but importantly, water actually is made of particles, right? It's just shown as blue background. But keep in mind the components of a solution. Solute particles and solvent particles are both parts of the solution, right? So the water molecules, which aren't shown individually here, are there. They are the molecules of solvent. These orange balls are the solute particles. And what we have here, represented by the dashed line, is a selectively permeable membrane. A selectively permeable membrane is one that is only permeable only to certain kinds of particles. Permeable means that they can get through. To permeate means to go through. So a membrane is a boundary, but it's not necessarily a boundary for everything. A selectively permeable membrane is one that certain things can get through, but only certain things. And so we have this chamber at the top. It's the same chamber, but at different stages in time. To start with, the chamber is divided into two subchambers separated by the selectively permeable membrane. And at first, you don't have any dye molecules on the right chamber. You have them only in the left chamber. That is a gradient, right? There is some positive concentration of dye particles on the left chamber, in the left chamber. There's a zero concentration of orange particles on the right. So that is the gradient. There's a difference in concentration. It's not just a gradient, it's specifically a concentration gradient. And a gradient, if it exists, is the tendency for diffusion to occur. A concentration gradient is the tendency. What I mean here is that there has to be certain things true for diffusion to occur. One is that there has, and I'm talking about net diffusion, diffusion of the population, not an individual particle. For net diffusion to occur, there has to be a gradient, first of all. But that's not enough. It's necessary, but that's not sufficient. Importantly, there also has to be a way for whatever type of particle you're talking about to get from A to B. And there isn't always a way to get from A to B. Well, here there is, because the selectively permeable membrane is permeable to these particles. They can get through. And since the gradient exists, and since there is a way to get from high concentration to low concentration, that's what they do. They spread out simply for the same reason that I explained here with the gym. They're individually moving, so it is true that some of them are going to go from right to left, but since there's so many more of them to start with on the left than on the right, there's going to be more going from left to right than right to left. That's why they spread out. And if you wait long enough, it will come to equilibrium, which in this case, equilibrium is reached because the gradient goes to zero. If you no longer have a gradient because the concentrations are the same at the two places, then there is no longer a tendency for net diffusion. That doesn't mean any particles stop moving. They're all moving still. But at equilibrium, in this case, there's just as many moving from right to left as there are left to right. So there's no net diffusion. Net diffusion is more movement of particles in one direction than in another. Clear on that? All right, that's one way of reaching equilibrium. I'll talk about another one in a second. On the bottom, we have exactly the same thing happening for the orange dye, but in this case, we also have purple dye particles, and they start out only on the right subchamber, not on the left. The important concept here is that if you have multiple different types of solutes, then they will have completely independent gradients. And the gradients don't affect each other. In other words, the orange balls are moving toward the right only because of their own gradient. It has nothing to do with the purple particles. The purple ones are moving in the opposite direction, but they're going down their own gradient, which just happens to be in the reverse direction. And that's not affected by the orange ones at all either. Each type of particle is simply diffusing down its own gradient. The gradients are independent of each other if there are multiple types of solutes. And you let it happen long enough, then they'll both be at equilibrium. Okay, now, before I actually get to the particulars of 11, let me tell you that diffusion does not necessarily involve a membrane at all. The simplest example of diffusion does not involve a membrane. You know, if you plunk a sugar cube into a glass of water, that's a steep gradient, because where the sugar is pure sugar, no water, right at first. And all the surroundings is pure water, no sugar, right? So there's definitely a gradient from A, where the sugar is, to B, where the water is. And that's a tendency for sugar molecules to spread out, to diffuse. Well, that is diffusion. It's simple diffusion. There is no boundary that anything's passing. It's all one compartment. The example shown here is also diffusion, but it's diffusion through a selectively permeable membrane. And another example of a selectively permeable membrane is the plasma membrane of a cell. So diffusion can happen just within one compartment, or it can happen between two compartments separated by a membrane, selectively permeable membrane. In both cases, though, you have what's just called diffusion. There is another possibility, though, which is still diffusion, but it gets a separate name. What we've been talking about up to now, in calling it simply diffusion, is movement of solute particles down their gradient, right? Each type of solute moves down its own gradient. Not up, ever, because that wouldn't be passive, that would be active. It's moving down its gradient from high concentration to low concentration. A specialized case of diffusion, though, is called osmosis. And this is defined in different ways in different sciences, but it's usually defined by textbooks in a way that seems confusing. At least I think it is. You might have read something like this as the definition of osmosis. Movement of water from a region of low solute concentration to high solute concentration. Have you read something like that ever or heard, been taught that? It is true what I just said, but it seems like it's an exception. Because it seems like something's moving from low concentration to high concentration, which would be active transport, right? Osmosis is passive transport. Osmosis is diffusion. It's just a special case. But it's not actually anything moving from low concentration to high concentration. It's just confusingly worded. Let me repeat what that I just said that definition is. Movement of water from a region of low solute concentration to a region of high solute concentration. Well, what does it mean to be at a region of low solute concentration? That's just a backwards way of saying a region of high water concentration, right? Because if you have a very low solute concentration, a very weak solution, it's mostly water. That means you correspondingly have high water concentration. You see what I'm saying there? And if you have a high solute concentration, that's just a backwards way of saying low water concentration. Okay? And therefore, the more straightforward way of phrasing it would be to say osmosis is movement of water from high water concentration to low water concentration. In other words, osmosis is doing the same exact thing that this simple diffusion is, except you're talking about a different particle. Water instead of solute. Well, biology textbooks will always say water, and that's because in biology the solvent is always water. But water is not the only solvent in chemistry. And that's why the true definition is what I've just said, except instead of water, it's solvent. Osmosis is movement of solvent particles, not solute, down their concentration gradient. So from high solvent concentration to low solvent concentration. But that definition doesn't go far enough. And I'm working up to the complete definition, but let me tell you why it doesn't go far enough. Think back to the putting the sugar cube in a glass of water. You have solvent there, right? Water molecules. You really have two gradients in place the moment you put that sugar cube in. High sugar concentration at the cube, low in the water. That's one gradient. That's the sugar gradient. You also, though, simultaneously have a gradient for water. High water concentration in the water, low in the sugar cube. So water has its own independent gradient that it wants to diffuse down. And both particles will diffuse. Come back later and there's water where the sugar was, there's sugar where the water was. They've both gone down their gradients. That is diffusion. But even for the water, which is solvent, that is not osmosis. That's simply diffusion of water. So for something to be osmosis, the special case of diffusion, two things have to be true. What's moving is not solute, it's solvent, which is water for biology. And the movement has to be through a selectively permeable membrane, meaning that water can get through, but solutes can't. If the membrane is in place and it's water that's moving, then it is osmosis officially. You understand the difference between just diffusion of water and osmosis, as I just defined them? Let's look at a picture then. Here we have a bit of glassware that is the original U-tube. Now U-tube means something else. But the U-tube is fitted with a selectively permeable membrane at the bottom. So the right and left halves are two different chambers with two different solutions in them. Aqueous solutions, because we're talking about water as the solvent here. The solute particles are these green things, whatever they are. Doesn't matter what they are, they're solutes. And the point here is that the selectively permeable membrane is impermeable to the solutes. The green things cannot get through. The water can. All right? Now, just as before, there are two entirely independent gradients. There's a solute gradient and there's a solvent gradient. You can tell just by looking at it that there's a solute gradient, right? Because there's a higher concentration of these green particles on the right than on the left. The gradient for the solute particles exists here. That means there is a tendency for the green particles to diffuse. But that's not enough, right? There also has to be a way for them to get through, to diffuse from A to B. So they want to, in a sense, go from right to left, the green particles, but they can't because they can't get through the pores of the membrane. Meanwhile, there's a completely independent gradient for water, but in the opposite direction, right? The lower solute concentration on the left just means a higher water concentration on the left than on the right. So water is diffusing not because of the solute particles. Water is simply following its own gradient and going from high water concentration to low water concentration through a membrane. That's what makes it osmosis, through the membrane. And so it does that. And the reason it does that is because the source of energy is the gradient itself. That's what drives it. It's passive. You don't have to add any energy to that. The energy is built in. Now, if you imagine that happening, since water is the only thing that can get through, that means as water moves from left to right, you're removing material from the left in the form of water and adding it to the right. No solutes are moving because they're locked in whichever side they're in. And therefore, the total volume on the left goes down and the total volume on the right goes up. Well, this is a second way that you can come to equilibrium. Before, I said that it will come to equilibrium if the gradient is eliminated. And actually, it looks like the gradient has been eliminated here, too, because these look now to be about the same concentration, right? If there is no more gradient, then there is no more tendency for water to go in one direction more than another. So it would stop at that point. But you have to imagine this because I don't have a picture. Let's start with everything identical except there being no green particles at all in the left. Just pure water. Water still has a gradient forcing it to the right. Right? Green particles still want to go to the left, but they can't. You still have pure water in the left, though. These ones aren't here, these green particles. So you're still removing water from the left, adding it to the right. The water level is getting higher in the right side. But no matter, if you start with zero solute particles on the left, it doesn't matter how much water you remove, it's still going to be more watery here than here, right? Because there's no solute particles here. So it doesn't eliminate the gradient. It will still come to equilibrium, though, because the higher you make that right side column, the more it's being pulled down by gravity. And gravity is pushing it to the left, exactly the opposite force compared to the osmosis pushing it to the right. And when those two forces exactly equal each other, even though the gradient still exists for osmosis, no more osmosis will occur. Be exactly balanced. That's another way to come to equilibrium. Okay, that's just a detail picture on the bottom. So that brings up the third and final slide for this bit of information. Slide 12 has to do with tonicity. And I want you to be really careful with these words because a lot of people who should know better use these incorrectly. Students use them incorrectly, so do some instructors. And they might even be used incorrectly in your packets that replace the manual, because the manual has gotten this wrong in the past. I actually haven't checked on that entirely, but obey me, not necessarily what the packet says, all right? But tonicity is a general word that refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur. And specifically, it refers to tendency of osmosis to occur into or out of a cell. What you see on the top of the slide is that there are three categories of tonicity. Hypotonicity, which is the noun or hypotonic adjective, isotonic, and hypertonic. And this is where the confusion comes in. This is partly where the confusion comes in. Because these seem to be named backwards, just like osmosis seems to be defined backwards. Before I give you the three definitions, though, let me just tell you that, and this might be what's wrong, if there is an error in your packets, this is what's wrong. Don't ever use these words, any one of these three words, to describe a cell. That's wrong. These words should only be used to describe the surroundings of the cell, what the cell is immersed in other words, not the cell itself. But there's these three possibilities. And they're all relative words because they're all based on a comparison to the cell itself. The cell is a container that has its own solution in it, right? So that's one solution. And that's why it can be a comparison. You're comparing the solution inside the cell to the solution outside of the cell. But when you use these three words, you're describing the environment and not the cell. Okay, now to why it seems like they're backwards definitions. The prefix hypo means what?
Below.
Means below, like in hypodermic, below the skin, right? Well, the reason this seems backwards, at least to me, is that these words are used to describe osmosis, which is movement of water, solvent. But the prefixes are used to describe the solutes, not the water. Hypo meaning low. A hypotonic solution is a solution that has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. That's where the hypo comes from, lower, but it's lower solute, okay? The backwardsness of that is that hypotonic, meaning lower solute concentration than the cell, means more watery than the cell, right? Because lower solute concentration means higher water concentration. And it's the water concentration that matters. That's what drives the osmosis. So that's why the definitions kind of piss me off. But that's what hypotonic always means. It always refers to the environment. And it applies only in the situation where the environment's solute concentration is lower than the solute concentration in the cell, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell. That's the better way to memorize it. It's more watery, because that's what matters. If it's more watery, then that means there is a water gradient, right? So there's the tendency for diffusion. Water is a solvent, and it's going through a membrane if it moves. Therefore, all the requirements are in place for it to be osmosis. And on the top row, we have an animal cell in a hypotonic solution at first. Well, remember I told you that animal cells don't have cell walls. They have only plasma membranes, which are pretty flimsy devices. So the water is going down its gradient, as it's always going to in diffusion, and osmosis is always diffusion. It's going down its own gradient from high water concentration to low water concentration. It's less watery inside the cell, so that's where the water goes. You're adding volume to the cell, therefore it expands, and that if it's the gradient is steep enough, or if you let this happen long enough, then the plasma membrane cannot hold the pressure and it will explode the cell. That explosion of the cell is called lysis. Remember, it means splitting. You rip the bag open. Well, I shouldn't have to tell you that that is bad for the cell. It kills the cell. So animal cells don't do well in a hypotonic environment, in a more watery than themselves environment. Let's look at the other extreme first before going to the middle. Hyper means above, but once again, it's named for the solute, not for the water. So a hypertonic environment is one that has a higher solute concentration than the cell does, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell itself. It's only the water gradient that matters, not the solute gradient, because the solutes can't get through the membrane. Water is always, if there is a gradient, going to go down its gradient. It's just that in this case of a hypertonic solution, the gradient is in the opposite direction. It's more watery in the cell than outside the cell. So water is going to leave the cell instead of going in. That, of course, is going to reduce the volume of the cell because you're not replacing the water that's lost with anything. And therefore, the animal cell in this hypertonic environment is going to shrivel. That shriveling is called crenation, with an N, not an M. Crenation. Crenation is also bad for the cell. If it's drastic enough, it will kill it. So, animal cells, by virtue of having only a plasma membrane and not also a cell wall, don't do well in either extreme, in hypertonicity or hypotonicity. Iso is a prefix that means the same. So an isotonic solution is any solution that has the same overall solute concentration as the cell does. Now notice I didn't say anything about what solutes we're talking about, because the two compartments, exterior of the cell and interior of the cell, can have entirely different types of solutes. As long as they're in equal concentrations outside and inside. And that's the reason that they can be different solutes is that the solutes really don't matter. It's the wateriness. But if you have a 5 molar salt concentration outside and a 5 molar sugar concentration on the inside, different solutes, that means they're equally watery, right? It's the wateriness that matters. So isotonicity means that there is no water gradient. Equally watery inside and outside the cell. It doesn't mean water doesn't move. It just means that it moves out of the cell at the same rate as it moves into the cell, and therefore there's no volume change. That's the normal, healthy situation for a typical animal cell like this erythrocyte or red blood cell. And this is why we spend so much energy as part of homeostasis maintaining osmolarity within limits. If you just chug gallons of distilled water, you're going to be in trouble because it doesn't have any solutes. You're going to make your environment of your cells very hypotonic. Okay, that's for animal cells, but look at what's happening with a plant cell on the bottom. Plant cells, remember, have a plasma membrane also, but exterior to that, they have this very thick, sturdy cell wall. So if you put a plant cell in a hypotonic environment, meaning more watery than the cell, water is going to have the same gradient as if you put an animal cell in a hypotonic environment, meaning it's going to go from more watery outside to less watery inside. And that's going to swell the cell just like it does the animal cell, but once it bulges up and becomes turgid or swollen, then the cell wall will hold the pressure. There's still a gradient. More water wants to come in, but it's like the gravity preventing it in the U-tube, except it's the sturdiness of the cell wall. It pushes back until they exactly equal each other. And that will be a swollen or turgid individual plant cell. That's the healthy, that's the best situation. Now, a plant is more than one cell, right? It's millions of cells, trillions of cells. But this is why it's healthy for a plant. This is how a plant can stand up. Even a green seedling, hasn't become woody yet, is pretty much just like an erection of a penis. It's driven by pressure. In a penis, the pressure is blood pressure, right? Because you have more blood coming in than coming out than leaving. But in a plant, if you give it enough water, in other words, you create a hypotonic environment, that water is going to go into the cells individually. Each of them will swell, but they're connected to each other, so they're going to push on each other, which stiffens the stem of the plant. If you forget to water them, eventually the environment is no longer going to be hypotonic, right? It's going to go to isotonic, in which case they're going to become, the cells will become flaccid. They're limp. So they're not pushing on each other, and the stem will sag. You can rescue it if you get it in time by just adding water and restoring hypotonicity. So a plant can survive, at least temporarily, isotonicity, but it does best in hypotonicity. Hypertonicity, both types of cells do badly. It can kill the animal cell, it can also kill the plant cell, but the plant cell still has the cell wall. When water leaves the cell, as it's going to in a hypertonic environment, it's going to, you know, the water is inside the plasma membrane to begin with, on the inside of the plasma membrane. And when it leaves, that is going to cause the plasma membrane, which is like I said, kind of like the paint on the interior of the wall, it's going to cause that plasma membrane to peel away from the cell wall, which will destroy the cell. And that is called plasmolysis. That's the verb form of it. But it's plasmolysis is how it's spelled, plasmolysis. Just don't confuse plasmolysis, since it has lysis in it, with lysis. Those are opposites. Lysis is the bursting, overswelling of an animal cell in a hypotonic environment. Plasmolysis is the plant version of crenation. It shrinks in response to a hypertonic environment. Do all those definitions make sense? Yeah.
Can there be such thing as like a hypotonic?
Oh yeah, every one of these have degrees. They're, you know, technically speaking, the only environment that's isotonic. And it depends on the cell as well. Whatever the cell's concentration is, if the concentration of the environment is exactly the same, then it's isotonic. If it's anything other than that, it's either hypotonic, which could be mildly or severely hypotonic, or in the other direction. So yes, there are certainly degrees to each of these three categories. Or to the two categories. There's isotonic, there's really only one. But there's no such thing as an isotonic solution on itself, by itself, right? It's only isotonic compared to a cell that's in it. If you put a different cell with a different concentration in that same stuff, it's no longer going to be isotonic. These are all words that are relative to the cell. But you only use the words to describe the environment, not the cell. Any other questions? All right, then let me talk about the report you have to write. And not the whole report, because you can follow the instructions for the report. By the way, all you need to do is the necessary stuff for being here today. You're not writing your report today. And I say that because you haven't even gotten your saltwater reports graded. They just barely have been turned in, especially since we did things in different orders this term. I don't want you to even start writing these things until you get results for until you get comments from me about your saltwater report. Okay, so get your stuff done for today, but then kind of put it on the back burner until you at least get those results. But anyway, you are eventually drawing a graph or creating a graph for this one, which can be hand drawn or machine drawn as before. Well, where does your independent variable go on a graph?
Horizontal,
the x-axis. What is the independent variable? The concentration of solution, right. So write it out and have your unit. What are your units? Not moles. Molar. Capital M. And what's your dependent variable today? Right, you're measuring mass, but what you don't want to graph mass. Mass is your raw data, what you directly obtain in the experiment. That's what you're directly measuring, right? But notice you're measuring twice. You're measuring before and after. And so what you want to graph is the change in mass, which is often in science abbreviated as a delta for change, which will be in grams, right? Well, a difference in mass can be calculated two different ways, but what's the correct way to calculate change in mass? What I mean by two ways of calculating it is if there's a difference, you can subtract one from the other or the first from the second. Which is the correct way here? Change in mass equals what? Just the opposite. Change in mass is mass final minus mass initial. Here's why that makes sense. If the mass increases, that means the final mass is going to be bigger than the initial mass, right? So if you define it this way, final minus initial, bigger minus smaller is going to be a positive number. A positive delta means an increase. Right? But that doesn't mean it has to be positive. If your sample loses mass, then that means the final is going to be smaller. You still calculate it the same way, though, final minus initial. It's just going to be smaller minus bigger, so it's going to be a negative number. So don't graph the individual measurements of mass. Calculate from your raw data the change in mass, and then graph that. Since it could be positive, negative, or zero, that means zero should not be down here. Right? Zero should be somewhere in the middle of the y-axis. You have negative numbers down here, positive numbers up here. But make your scale correct, evenly spaced, because it's a numeric axis. Now you have how many changes in mass are you going to have? Three, because you have three batches of potatoes, three concentrations that you're working with, right? So three X's, you're going to have three Y's corresponding. Now, depending on what your data are, you're going to get 3 points, but if you just have, let's say, here, here, and here, I'm not saying that's how yours are going to turn out. I'm just saying, just putting down some points. Well, if you consider this to be linear, which is not perfectly, of course, but if you say that that is close enough to be linear that it justifies having a linear best fit line, then remember, it doesn't necessarily go through any point, but it would be roughly that. The thing that people do not understand in this is what I'm about to tell you. So I'm telling you the correct way of doing this, which means none of you should not do this, but I can almost guarantee you that some of you are not going to do what I'm going to tell you to do. There's a part of the, unless you changed it, there's a question in the report that asks for you to find the solute concentration inside the cell, the cells of your potato. Right, which is all from the same potato, so all the cells should have the same concentration of solute in them. And so students say, how in the hell am I supposed to know that? We didn't directly measure that at all. And no, you didn't. This has to do with the definitions that I just gave you. All right, you're not measuring any concentrations. You're measuring masses, and you're computing mass changes, right? But what would have to be true for a solution, and it's not necessarily one of the three that you used, but for a solution to be isotonic to those potatoes, what would have to be true of it based on the definition of isotonicity? What? Equally watery. Right, it would have to be equally watery as the cell for it to be an isotonic solution. And if it's equally watery, what does that say about the water gradient? It would be zero. And if there is zero water gradient, which way is water moving? Both at the same time, but not more out than in and not more in than out. Therefore, what would you expect the change in mass to be? Zero. That's what this line is used for. Once you fit this line, it's going to somewhere cross the zero line for y. Correct? Here's where you use interpolation. Interpolation predicts values for y based on x's that you didn't actually measure. But wherever this crosses zero, that means the corresponding x value is what you would expect. If whatever that x value for molar is, the concentration, you would expect that concentration to result in a zero change in mass. If it results in a zero change in mass, that must be the case that the concentration in the exterior solution, which is what the x value is, must be the same as the concentration of solutes in the potato, because they're equally watery, right? And so that's what the question's asking for. The potato's concentration is simply the concentration of the bathing solution if it's isotonic. Everyone follow that? The potato's concentration of solutes is going to be exactly the same as the solute concentration for an isotonic solution, by definition. And you can find where isotonicity is by figuring out what the concentration, the x value is that corresponds to a zero change in mass. So that's how you get that answer. And therefore do that to get those points. But does that not make any sense to anyone?
It will when we get there.
Okay. Yeah, well, you should be listening to this again before you make your report anyway. That was the major thing. Unrelated to the potato experiment, well, once again, make sure you use consistency in how you let your wet potatoes drip before you get your final mass, and that will give you good numbers. But unrelated to the potato experiment, clean up. You have this, which I don't understand why this confuses so many people, but it does. People will come up to these and they will think that this is two containers. Well, of course it actually is two containers, but there are labels here, before and after, which means you're supposed to imagine this is the same container before and after. All right? Don't think of it as two separate containers. This one's before and after with different contents. So there's really two containers here, not four, but shown at two different times. And so make sense of that when you get to that part of it. It doesn't take very long to look at that stuff. And you also have those transparencies of the red blood cells that you should make sense of. So you really have to, in terms of being out of here today, you have to go through, I think, page 8. Is that where it ends the... Let me see. Yeah, as soon as you're done with page 8, that's where you're done. Now, the reason you have the whiteboards out, so now we're back to the potato thing. The reason you have the whiteboards out is to draw pictures of the three conditions. And what I want here is each of the three conditions draw just one big cell, not multiple cells. One plant cell, one potato cell. Each of them should have three different kinds of symbols used. You should use three different kinds of symbols in these pictures. Like squares, triangles, circles, whatever. So you need a key to tell me which symbol is what. But you need a symbol for water particles, a symbol for sucrose particles, and a symbol for... starch. Okay? Put them in relative abundance where they are in those three situations. And then In other words, indicate the gradient by showing there's a higher concentration of something somewhere other compared to the cell. And then label them with the words hypotonic, hypertonic, and isotonic. Fit them with arrows to show you which way the particles are going to move. All right, now what particles are able to move in this situation? Only the water. So you're drawing three different particle types, but two of them can't get through the membrane. Some of them are going to be locked in, some of them are going to be locked out. But water can go through. That's why it's osmosis. All right, so label them all properly. Not only to do it, to learn it yourself and to explain to each other, but importantly, don't erase it before you leave. Take a picture of it. Because if you include that picture in your report, you get extra points. All right. Erase it before you leave, but make sure everyone has a picture of it before you go today. All right, I'm done.